Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how are you doing?
Hot.
As always.
As always, yes. A little bit of background information for our listeners. It's now the middle of summer. Mona's asking me, should she turn off her air conditioning? And I said, no, I don't. She's sweating all over the microphone for this interview. And in addition to the ambient temperature, we're also covering a hot topic about material change. And we have a great guest to cover it, don't we, Mona?
We do indeed. I'm delighted to actually introduce to you Carolyn Lee, who is one of the most prominent lawyers out there in the EB5 sphere. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Mona, and thank you so much. That's very kind of you.
Well, Carolyn, it's very kind of you to come on EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you, Mark.
Carolyn Lee has represented regional centers, developers, funds, and investors for over a decade, helping U.S. project clients raise $2.5 billion in EB5 capital. She is the chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association National EB5 Committee and is the new chair of IIUSA's Public Policy Committee.
So, Carolyn, as I said, it's wonderful to have you on the show. We've got so much to discuss in such little time. With the long processing delays, Carolyn, there's so much happening in the industry. We wanted to discuss things like material change, which a lot of people don't really understand. And there's a lot of clarifications required. But before we get into that, I'm so delighted you're going to chair the Public Policy Committee of IIUSA.
Yes, thank you so much. Yes, I'm taking up the post of chairing the Public Policy Committee of IIUSA. For your audience members who don't know what IIUSA is, it's the oldest EB5 trade association. And the members are comprised of regional centers, developers, providers in the EB5 space.
And lawyers.
And lawyers, absolutely. Yes, very importantly, lawyers. The work of the Public Policy Committee is developing the position of the industry, or at least of the IIUSA Trade Association, on the emerging issues of the day in EB5.
And there's a lot which is happening. So as I started off by implying, right now, Karen, we're beset by delays by USCIS. And whereas for somebody filing a petition, you wouldn't think that, you know, it really would cause so many problems. Though what we are seeing, and I'm sure, you know, you're seeing the same thing, is that delays makes a difference, a huge difference with projects. And projects do different things during when they have a lot of time. When is a material change, or when can a material change issue really kick in?
Yeah, the increase in processing times is a huge problem in our industry.
Right.
And there has been a gradual increase in processing times, as we all know, but there's really been a quantum jump up from 24 to 29 months to 45.5 in just the last few weeks. And this is very concerning overall, of course, but it has specific issues with respect to the topic we're talking about today, which is material change.
Right. So just to clarify, Carolyn, for the listener who may not be so sure what we're talking about with a material change, what we're discussing today are material changes within the actual EB5 project.
That's right.
So if I asked you, what is a material change? I know the definition has changed many times. What is it today in 2019?
Oh my. So that really is the multi-million dollar question. And I would say the key problem, I would say it is a problem that we have in our industry, is that we don't have a clear definition of what USCIS deems to be material change. This is not a concept that's in the statute or the regulations. It's a creature of policy and a fairly recent vintage of that. So what material change is it can be really any change that a project experiences which wouldn't be so bad in sort of the abstract, absolute sense. And we know that every business is live and it undergoes changes day to day, big and small. The issue is that there are consequences, really adverse, harsh consequences from an immigration standpoint, if USCIS should deem any particular change or set of changes to be material change.
Right. And why I say it in 2019 is because we've both been at this in this industry for some time. And what we saw back in 2008 and what we see now is completely different. You know, EB-5 has evolved. But a lot of our listeners, Carolyn, they like to do their own projects. And people tend to think that material change is something which just happens with a regional center project and maybe a large construction project. And I would like to clarify that, no, material change can happen even in the smallest of standalone entrepreneurial project, as well as the larger EB-5 projects.
That is true. It's not a concept that's limited to regional centers.
So, Carolyn, if you had to have one definition of material change or something you would say, this is a material change, what would you say that is?
Yeah, I would say a substantial change, a big change. We have to trust USCIS to not nitpick at small day-to-day changes in the course of a business's life. As a business does what it does, it's just going to evolve and change. And we just have to trust that USCIS will not take the position that any old change rises to the level of a material change. And we should mention what those really adverse consequences of material change are.
Yes, absolutely.
If your EB-5 petition is pending, and now, you know, they could be pending for up to 4 years, it's deniable. It can be denied. USCIS can deny that petition. If your petition is approved and you're not yet admitted in conditional permanent residency status, your approved petition can be revoked. So these are really harsh consequences. So we have to trust that USCIS will act reasonably and not arbitrarily in finding ordinary changes to be material. So I'm going to say, if there is a big change, a substantial change, a change that makes you go really from sort of an intuitive, practical stance, wow, this feels big. This feels like this may be of concern to USCIS. That's the kind of change that we should focus on.
Well, I would disagree on one point here, Carolyn, because I feel that small changes could be material if they were essential. So let's take an example of an offering. If someone has a building and they want to have, say, 10 investors, just a $5 million offering, because we're seeing smaller offerings, and suddenly they change the interest rate. Maybe they lower the interest. They started with a 6% or 8% interest rate, and then they lower it to 2% within the offering documents. Couldn't that be considered a material change?
Well, I mean, I think, Mona, the point that you make really raises the hazard of this entire area. What's a small change to me? It might be a big change to you. The concept of big and small, yes, is very, very subjective. So I tried to start with the idea that we focus on the big change, but you're absolutely right. That can be a very subjective idea, so maybe that's not so helpful. I do look at some things that I think USCIS could be and maybe even should be concerned about when I analyze whether or not a change is might be material. And I know you're going to ask me about some specific hypothetical scenarios, but I can talk about some principles and some concepts that I look at to help me anchor an analysis of a set of changes. So one thing I look at, and we'll try to come back to your particular example of an interest rate change. One thing that I start by looking at is the impact on jobs and where are we on the jobs and where are we in project progress? And again, it doesn't matter whether this is a direct investment, a regional center, small, large, in terms of the project scale. Where are we? How far have we gone? What's the nature of the derailment? How many jobs have been created? And if there have been already enough jobs, the project has progressed to a point where we have enough jobs. Was your example 2.5 million? So we have more than 50 jobs already in that scenario. Well, I'm going to allow myself a little sigh of relief there because I know that at least we can check that box. And we want to be comfortable. We want to be assured that we can check that box. So,
but Carolyn, what if somebody only went into this particular project because they thought there was a surplus of jobs and now the change happened and there's no surplus of jobs anymore? Would that be a material change if it would change specifically an investor's inclination?
So let's be clear. Anything can be. So to your specific question, sure. Yes. Anything can be material change because there just has not been a definition of what is a material change. But one way of talking about material change and the way that I'm talking about it is, well, what are the ways in which we would explain and defend these changes as not rising to the level of being a material change? So this is a way in which you want to appropriate or take the fact that we haven't had a robust definition on material change, which we have asked USCIS to give us time and time again. So in the absence of a checkbox or an objective standard, which would be very helpful in the context of material change, well, we can take that and we can work with that and we can look for ways in which a change might not be material.
That's a very good way of looking at it. Mona, do you have any examples or scenarios for Carolyn?
So we have a project. It's a small hotel and they want to put in 10 investors. Now suddenly they're not getting zoning for everything they want to get. So they're moving, they're shifting part of the project to say another part of that same area. It's still a TEA. It's still the same location. However, it's still a TEA. It's still the same state and city, but it's not the same location. Would the change in the project because of the zoning issues be the change of the location? If everything else is the same, would that be a material change?
So again, it could be because again, anything could be. But what would we say about those specific facts? We would say, look at, absolutely, these are the changes. It's not in the exact same location. Here are the similarities with the original business plan. And you want to go back to the original business plan. It's the same kind of business. We're doing the same kind of thing. Maybe the parties are the same. You're certainly going to have the same new commercial enterprise. So that's the same. And we're going to use the same job creation modeling. It's the same kind of use. So we're going to emphasize the similarities. And in the context of all of that, when I advise clients, I like to give USCIS, when there's an opportunity to present these facts in the context of an 829 or an interfiling, I like to present the narrative, what actually happened, because I think it's fair for an examiner looking at changed facts to want to know. Ultimately, they want to be assured that there is no fraud happening.
Right.
So you want to show USCIS, no, there is no fraud. Yes, things didn't happen exactly the way that we hoped and planned. And these are the ways in which there are the departures. These are the departures. But here are all the reasons why you shouldn't be concerned. And part of painting that picture for USCIS is explaining what happened. What's the context? Why did this happen? Why did the original project get derailed? Why didn't the permit issue in this instance? And you also want to show, to the extent that your actual facts support it, all of your diligence. The permit didn't issue, but it wasn't because of lack of our effort. It was due to these factors that were beyond our control,
right?
Despite our best efforts. And also part of painting this picture is showing all the steps that you took to mitigate. You realize that things were not going well, and these are the steps that you took to try to get back on track. I think that's important as well.
I agree. I think that kind of instance probably would not be a material change. Now,
well, it could be. It could be. And I think that's very, very important is I don't look at a set of facts and go, oh, okay, great. You know, we have those jobs. There's no material change. No, no, no. And you want to be, as advisors, you want to be very careful about advising your client. There really is no assurance that USCIS will not find material change in any instance. It's about how to put the best foot forward and to defend your change.
Hmm. Well, we do a lot of co-counseling, which I know you also do, Carolyn, and we often get RFEs from other attorneys, and they made me a mistake, for example, in the operating agreement or in the language in some of the documents, and they want to fix that language and send it back. And we advise that this language, as far as we can see, is a material change. Do you see that? Because it's correcting a document which was not correct at the time of filing.
That can be perilous. And sometimes they're not. You know, they're sort of administrative changes like typos. And everyone, all the advisors, the corporate attorneys, the securities attorneys, the transactional attorneys, the immigration attorneys, all feel reasonably comfortable that this is an administrative, ministerial kind of a corrective change and not a deal change or a material change. So sometimes you have that scenario and fine and good. And then you move forward. You can include the corrected versions in subsequent filings, and maybe you even annotate the subsequent filing with, here, we made these corrections, and give notice to USCIS. Other times you have to be very, very careful, and there's a wide zone of gray. That's what this is about. It's about, we've got very, very, very narrow bands at the extreme where, you know, we think, okay, this is definitely not a material change, or it definitely should not be, I should say, material change. And then on the other extreme, oh yeah, you know, it's very, very likely that this might be deemed a material. We're mostly talking about managing this vast gray area in between. And so when you know you're in there, you're very, very careful about making changes to these documents midstream because of the principle behind matter of Caddick-Back, of which the material change policy is sort of it's an offshoot of that decision, but it's sort of a strangled offshoot. It's not, it shouldn't be an offshoot, but it is. And we can try to delve into that a bit if you'd like, Mona.
Karen, one of the big hot topics, not so much these past few months because USCIS seemed to be asleep, but prior to this year, one of the big hot topics was the amount of closure of regional centers. Now, if you have a project in a regional center and suddenly they've been issued with a notice of intention to terminate and they do get terminated and you move your project because you're only at 526 level and you haven't even filed your 829 to a different regional center,
yeah.
Is that a material change?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So this is an area, one of maybe two, where USCIS has told us that this is a per se instance of material change.
So this is where I feel like, you know, our work with the Public Policy Committee really could make a difference, because so much of what USCIS does is through policy, and this is not fair. You know, if you have a project and it's terminated through no fault, the regional center is terminated through no fault of yours, say you've just rented that regional center, then it's not your fault. Shouldn't there be some kind of discretionary fact?
I think I see where you're going with this, Mona. So you're wondering if the Public Policy Committee could perhaps draft something for USCIS to have a look at? Something related to due process?
We definitely will be considering that. One of the earlier things that we'll be doing on the Public Policy Committee, the new session hasn't gotten underway yet, is going to be setting priorities for our year going forward. And that is absolutely a critical issue for us to study because of the impact on innocent investors.
Carolyn, for me and for those listening, how does USCIS formulate its policies? And why are they so important for EB-5?
Yeah. Well, the regulatory process is very long and uncertain in terms of when it crosses the finish line and becomes published regulations. So USCIS has resorted to publishing policy. They are usually in the form of memoranda. In immigration, the prior memoranda and the adjudicator's field manual, which served as policy guidance in immigration until the very recent past, have been replaced by the online policy manual. So anyone can Google the USCIS policy manual, and this consolidated comprehensive USCIS policy manual will pop up. And one of the sections deals with immigrant investors or EB-5. So it's agency guidelines for adjudicating immigration benefits. And so the agency operates under various authorities, right? It's got the statute, it has regulations,
yeah.
And it also has policy. Statutes, you know, are passed by Congress. Regulations have to go through its process involving the OMB's review, and ultimately they have to be published on the Federal Register before they are effective. And so policy is a shorter way, by way of the duration of the process, that agencies can use to publish its guidelines, its positions on adjudicating immigration benefits.
And Karen, they're not. It's not often that they're following law or precedent. I mean, sometimes they just make their own policies up as they go along. No, isn't that correct?
They do, and it can be very problematic in a couple of different ways. At least if it's written, we have some notice, and then, of course, there's the issue of even when it's written, do we have assurance that the effect will be prospective only from the time of the publication of the policy or revision to policy, or does it look back and have retroactive impact on pending cases, which again is a huge problem when we have cases that are pending for 4 years. You could have a case that was filed in 2019 and then in 2023 have a case be decided under completely different policy guidelines. Well, that is, as you say, Mona, that would be a due process problem. So we need to assure the stakeholders, the agency needs to assure stakeholders that anything that is published via policy will have prospective impact only. And we have yet to get that from the agency. But again, as long as it's written, at least it's written. Traditionally, one of our challenges in EB-5, and I would say probably in immigration generally, has been sort of policymaking by adjudication with no written notice, with USCIS adopting certain new positions in the course of adjudicating a case. The indebtedness issue is a good example.
That's a good example. And so the same with the geographic area expansion. They changed that midway also.
That's right. So we need to hold the agency accountable and do what we can as advocates to persuade USCIS that the policies that it adopts, of course, should be lawful and adhere to statute and regulations, and also as a matter of due process, be prospective with notice only.
Right, because often an EB-5 investor would not see that, yes, it's a great business, but it may not fall under the EB-5 guidelines for some silly reason, actually, and including the fact that perhaps the geographic area doesn't fall where he wants it, he doesn't have the right regional center coverage or something or another.
Right. And in my mind, Mona, it really comes down to the agency gaining more competence and confidence. Businesses are businesses. And so when there's a change, when a business goes from one geography, one area to another area, that's not necessarily in and of itself a reason for USCIS to get concerned. It can choose to focus on these technical changes and find reason to be concerned. But when you sort of look at the change and you can assure yourself that this is really a change that's happening kind of in the ordinary course, there's been no fraud. There's not been lack of diligence. This was carefully planned. And yet these changes happened and these managers are managing the change as best they can. And this is the outcome of those efforts. I'm hoping that with time and with greater competence and expertise among the examiners and with
that's a big hope, Karen.
And with leadership, that we will have a rational adjudication of material change.
So, Carolyn, you're so knowledgeable in this particular area. I know it's because you've had a lot of experience. And of course, you are one of the best when it comes to anything difficult and academic.
Hey, no,
you are.
You Mona.
Are. Many a time, Mark, we will have a conversation in a public policy meeting and we get to something really hard. And suddenly there's silence. And then we hear this little chirping from Carolyn, who's the only one who understands the issue.
Oh, that is not true, but thank you.
Like a very supportive coach. This is hard. We can do it.
It is untrue.
Yeah, but what I would like to say, though, is that in the past, we've written to USCIS, we've pleaded, we've asked. Sometimes they've listened. A lot of times they haven't. Karen, what do you see as making a difference moving forward? How can we really get USCIS to listen to some of these issues? Say regarding material change, where things are just not material changes, and why are they thinking they're material changes? Or actions, for example, relating to the termination of regional centers when it's not your fault, or some other reason. What do you feel?
I think it takes persistence. We will be talking a lot on the Public Policy Committee and also in ALA and on our EB5 committee about how to break through what I call the wall of silence. We really need to have dialogue with the agency so that it can do its job better. And so we as stakeholders have better noticed, and we produce filings that are going to be successful. So to do that, we need communication, and we have not had that.
Yeah.
And we have not had substantive communication that I think is so important in this complex area for both sides, for both government and the private stakeholders. So
we were getting there. We were getting there a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago. We did have that sort of stakeholders meeting, and then we had an event here where we had the IPO coming.
We were.
But that sort of fizzled out, and we've written to the IPO many times since then, and we haven't been able to set anything else up again. So he's hoping.
There have been changes within leadership and with the administration. So I think we need to be persistent,
yes,
respectful, and yet demand accountability and transparency, which involves communicating with stakeholders.
And with all the changes, the upcoming changes happening, Carolyn, do you see EB5 as dying a death or being as strong as ever?
Absolutely not dying a death. I would say no to that and yes to being as strong as ever. This is a relatively new benefit and program within our immigration laws. It was just created in 1990. So we are going through a natural, I believe, natural evolution and growth. It's important, I think, to see it as such and to see the opportunities for the program to grow in a much more robust, healthy way. I believe that it will.
Well, this discussion has been insightful for me and I hope helpful for the listeners. Understanding the big gray area that is material change and understanding the Public Policy Committee's influence over the EB5 program. Carolyn Lee, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
It has been my pleasure, Mark. Thank you, and Mona.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.